Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to Overnight America with Ryan Recker on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
And welcome to Overnight America. So exciting to be back with you tonight. I'm your host, Ryan Recker. You can follow me on Twitter at Ryan Recker. And if you miss any part of the show, you can download the podcast at KMOX.com/ONA. Oh, what a show last night. If you missed it, you can go to the website and hear it for yourself. The Hour with Doug and Donna. They were just fantastic. A couple of months back, Doug recorded the Overnight America theme on his cell phone. And then he sent it to me to preview, but instead I played it right on the air. And while I had it on the air, everyone was so impressed. We said, we got to get Doug in to record this. And lo and behold, last night was the day he was able to introduce the Overnight America theme song on the airwaves of KMOX.
Time of night, you can't stay uptight, so come and join the people that are feeling all right here on Overnight America. Overnight America.
I'll tell you, that gets you pumped up. I was so grateful that they came in and performed that. We did a full hour of music. They even took requests. Producer Mike got a request in there. Moon Dance by Van Morrison. It was fantastic the whole night. So I played that today for my son, Emmett. And I wanted him to hear it. I wanted him to get the idea like, hey, I want you to hear this song someone made for the radio show. And he was really interested into it, and he started to sing the song. So I said, hey, let's record it. Let's go downstairs real quick. I'll have you give a couple of words. So he doesn't know the lyrics. He couldn't memorize it in time, but he definitely caught the hook to it. Do you want to hear what my son recorded after listening to that?
Ooh, Overnight America. Ooh, Overnight America. Ooh, Overnight America. Ooh. Overnight America, ooh, Overnight America.
So that's what I heard for about an hour after playing him the theme song. It warms my heart. That's his radio debut. That's the first time his voice has ever been played on the show. Aw, a very special moment. I'm going to have to commemorate this with a plaque or something. Love him so much. So hopefully Doug is listening right now. He sent me an email earlier today. He was so thankful. He's like, oh, I'm so glad you had me in. I'm so thankful. And I'm like, no, Doug, it's I am overwhelmed by the effort you put into this. And I am so grateful that you even wanted to do this or you thought to do something like this. So I'm hoping he's listening right now. And I hope Don is listening right now. Both of them, too. I love them to death. They are fantastic. And I can't thank them enough. And I'm hoping he heard my son sing a little bit of the Overnight America theme song that he put together.
Ooh, Overnight America.
Love it. We're going to connect with Paul Richter. He's an author of a book called The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. He follows four diplomats. And sometimes you don't realize that you go into these very hostile areas and you could confront some pretty serious issues. I mean, we know what happened on September 11th with Christopher Stevens in Benghazi. And Hillary Clinton, that's a very famous example of what ambassadors can approach. But what about some of these other examples? He not only looks at Christopher Stevens, but a few other examples. And there's so many unbelievable stories that these ambassadors have to deal and face. We're going to talk to him about that in this whole hour, we're going to be having a conversation about it. It's real fascinating. His book's out now called The Ambassadors. Paul Richter coming up next on Overnight America KMOX.
Listening to KMOX has never been easier.
Siri, play KMOX.
And welcome back to Overnight America. Our guest this hour, and this is going to be a really fascinating conversation. I think you're going to learn a lot when we bring on Paul Richter. He's written about foreign policy and national security for the past three decades, a Washington-based reporter for the Los Angeles Times. He lives in D.C., and his latest book out that just came out last week, November 12th, it's called The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. And author Paul Richter, thank you so much for coming onto KMOX.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you. And for the full hour, we're going to be able to do this, at least until, 45 minutes, I should say. So your book, you talk about ambassadors in general. Some people don't realize the amount of danger some of these ambassadors are put into, and some of the different things that they're asked to do sometimes are a little out there. And you follow the story of four ambassadors. In fact, you talk even more broad about it. Can you kind of set up what The Ambassadors is all about?
Well, the ambassadors that I wrote about were part of a small circle of American career diplomats who were asked to go again and again to the toughest places in the greater Middle East in the decade and a half after 9/11. We were embroiled in all these wars, revolutions, upheavals of various kinds. You'll remember Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Egypt. It was just one tough spot after another. And these were people who were experienced and who could handle these chaotic situations where they had to lead large American missions that sometimes involved many hundreds of people.
Mm-hmm. Hundreds of people. And sometimes you don't realize, too, how many Americans we have at some of these embassies and those that may be working in some of these other countries. And we're talking also some very hostile areas, too. There's some very particular skills that these ambassadors hold.
That's exactly right. They've got to be managers of large groups. They have to be able to deal with foreign leaders who don't understand what we want, you know, aren't sometimes pleased that the Americans are there at all. These ambassadors have to be able to deal with the U.S. military. They have to take part in what are basically military operations, and they have to kind of invent American policy in these countries when Washington really doesn't know what's going on because events are so fast moving.
Yeah. So you follow the stories of Ryan Crocker, Ann Peterson, Robert Ford, and Christopher Stevens. And we'll talk some about that this hour on the program. But I want to know, what do you think makes for a great diplomat, someone that would be representing the United States in some of these areas?
Well, I think the first thing is these have to be people who are able to have great skills in working with foreign leaders, people who don't understand the U.S. all that well. The ambassadors have to kind of build relationships of trust because the U.S. comes in and it's asking these foreign leaders to do things that they may not want to do. And if they're suspicious of the American ambassadors or don't trust them, then it doesn't work. So it's really a matter of having kind of personal skills, the ability to understand these foreign leaders and to kind of, you know, find a basis for agreement with them as well. That's kind of at the heart of everything they do.
You know, and you're looking at these areas that include Afghanistan, Syria, Colombia, Benghazi. So do all of these foreign countries treat the diplomats the same as, let's say, France or someplace that'd be a little bit more friendly to Americans?
Not at all. I mean, we went into Iraq in 2003, and then we helped set up a new government after Saddam Hussein was driven from office. But the Iraqis who took over, they weren't all that pleased to have the U.S. there. and they had their own agendas. They had to worry about their rivalries with other, you know, groups that they were feuding with in Iraq. So there was a deep level of suspicion. They had multiple agendas, and the ambassadors, that our diplomatic leaders, had to be able to understand that and somehow get through to them and build cooperation. Another former diplomat who wrote about this said that sometimes being a diplomat is like going to Thanksgiving dinner with your most disagreeable relatives, only Thanksgiving dinner lasts all year. Huh. So, you know, it's a tough job.
When we talk about tough jobs, there's some tough jobs out there, but probably the name of those four ambassadors, the four diplomats that we named, Christopher Stevens, and because of the Benghazi and Hillary Clinton and what went on in the response time, you know, then the attack, and there's so much that has been documented about him. Was there anything that you learned about that diplomat, Christopher Stevens, that even surprised you?
Well, he was a fascinating guy. You know, he ended up in Libya, which turned out to be more dangerous for him as an ambassador than because he lost his life. I mean, he was the last ambassador to die for several decades before him. But he was a guy who did not really seek out this wartime situation. He went to Libya as the number two in the American embassy and didn't particularly want to serve in Iraq because he thought it was a situation where the U.S. military was in control. He wanted to go somewhere else, but he went to Libya even though it was in the middle of a civil war. He sneaked in a Greek cargo ship under a rain of bombs because the U.S. was bombing the Libyan government as part of a NATO operation then, you remember. And Stevens stayed because Washington wanted him to figure out who the rebel leaders were and build relationships with them. And he did that. And the next year, 2012, he came back as the U.S. ambassador to Libya, and he stayed. And he went to Benghazi because he hadn't been to the eastern part of the country for several months. And he really thought that the U.S. needed to be there. We needed to show the flag and start building a relationship with those people in eastern Libya. And that's what ultimately cost him his life, because it was really a dangerous part where a lot of militant groups that didn't like the U.S. had begun to sprout up.
Paul Richter joining us this evening on KMOX's new book that just came out called The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. So when you start to do research on a diplomat such as Christopher Stevens, someone that was still talked about to this day, I mean, when we look back and in general, whenever sometimes people talk about Hillary Clinton, they always show a picture of Christopher Stevens. Do you get a chance to talk to any of his family members or anyone that was close to him?
I did. I talked to a number of his friends. I talked to family members. And this is a guy who everybody liked. He had a special knack for building friendships with people. That was what people remember about him. He would sit down with people who didn't speak English that well. And when they got up after a while, they would feel like they were Chris's friends. That was true of the people who worked with him. That was true of the Libyans. He just had that certain skill. He was a guy from Northern California, kind of a typical Californian, very outdoorsy, very outgoing. He liked the things that most young people did. He trained as a lawyer. He was going to be a trade lawyer in Washington, D.C. for a while, and he might have made a nice, comfortable living at that. But that wasn't enough for him. He wanted to go out. He wanted to live overseas and meet new people in distant places. That was just what he yearned for. So at a relatively old age, after already being through law school, he joined the Foreign Service and he went abroad. First, he started out you know, in several countries in the Middle East. He went to Israel, worked with the Palestinians there for a while. He was just, he loved the job. He's one of these people who found it so invigorating to be there. He felt that he contributed, and, you know, it was just a natural for him.
Yeah, what's interesting about what you said was just how much interaction he had with the people that were there. Normally you think of diplomats, they have their own controlled location and a special plot of land that's dedicated to them with their buildings, and, you know, it's off limits and it's guarded. But you hear about sometimes these diplomats that go out and they get the moments to interact with the people that live there to try to get an idea of what they're going through, to get the lay of the land, try to talk to them and communicate with them. Is that a common thing for diplomats to do?
Well, you know, in the old days, before there was the threat of terrorism that American diplomats now face, it was routine for the ambassadors and their staffs, you know, the entire Foreign Service, to go out further and meet with people. That was the essence of the job, to get to know people, to get to understand these countries. But as things have developed, especially since 9/11, it's become more and more dangerous, because unlike in the past, these diplomats are on the kill list for all of these militant groups. Mm-hmm. And so now diplomats have had to retreat into their embassies, which are, you know, fortified and which have large, you know, staffs of bodyguards to protect them. It didn't used to be that way, and there's a big debate going on. It's been going on now for some years about to what extent U.S. diplomats should go out and mingle with people, because the real pros say you can't do the job unless you meet these foreign leaders and average people in these countries face to face.
You know, you are a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. You're based in Washington. Do you get out and talk to the people in D.C. to get an idea outside of, you know, the politicians you would speak to?
You mean
just you professionally? I'm just curious. Yeah, if you're someone that would do that too, you'd go out and say, "Okay, I need to talk to some people on the street, get an idea for the stories that you work on." Just because what you said about how the diplomats interact and they got to get a feel for it, I feel like reporters could humble themselves that way too, in the sense that they could talk to people as opposed to interviewing the politicians, the newsmakers, and try to get an idea too about, you know, other takes of what's going on in the news.
That is definitely part of reporting. You've put your finger on something. Mm-hmm. We need to do that, you know, for political reporters, for people who cover domestic news. That's the essence of it. And for people like me, who cover news in foreign countries, we've got to go out and try to meet people abroad as well, to understand in an unfiltered basis what people are thinking out in these places, because you can't rely all the time on other people to tell you what the mood of some city is.
You know, you tell the stories of America's ambassadors, the diplomats in foreign countries, and we just spoke about one, Christopher Stevens, but I want to tell the story of a few others that you have in your book, The Ambassadors. Do you mind holding on? We can continue our conversation.
Yes.
Perfect. He's going to be with us for the rest of the hour, the author Paul Richter, in the book that's out now called The Ambassadors. Go look it up. Just do a quick search, Paul Richter or The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. We'll continue with him next on KMOX.
Now back to Overnight America on KMOX. Sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com.
Welcome back to Overnight America. And I want to thank our guest who's sticking around this hour, Paul Richter, in the new book that just came out, The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. Thank you again for sticking around with us all hour.
Glad to do it.
I just happened to go to your Amazon.com page. So there's the book, The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. And I see your number one new release in Pakistan history category. So how about that?
Yes. I'm hoping for a lot of sales in Islamabad.
Yeah. So it says American ambassadors are the unconventional warriors. And I wanted to talk to you about why you decided to pick the four stories with Ryan Crocker, Robert Ford, Ann Patterson, and Christopher Stevens. What drew you to them in their stories?
Well, they weren't the only members of this group of talented career diplomats who went out to these places, but I thought their stories were especially lively and really kind of told the story of this era. Ryan Crocker is a six-time ambassador who's been basically everywhere tough in the Middle East. They call him the American Lawrence of Arabia.
Mm.
Robert Ford spent more time than anybody else in Iraq, and then he was the ambassador to Syria when the civil war broke out there. Ann Patterson was in Pakistan during some of its toughest times and had to make sure that the civilian government didn't collapse. Then she went to Egypt right after its revolution. And Chris Stevens, well, you know his story. He became kind of the most famous ambassador of the front lines when he was killed in 2012.
Mm. You know, these different stories, when you start to hear them and look at them, did you ever wonder for yourself personally, would I ever be able to take this job?
You know, I've asked myself that. I mean, it's these people really, not only did they handle all these tough situations, but they went back for more. You know, Crocker just kept signing up for all these tough assignments. Robert Ford and Chris Stevens didn't begin their careers thinking they were going to do this kind of stuff. They were both former Peace Corps volunteers who kind of liked, you know, a peaceful environment where they could meet people from exotic cultures and you know, get to know them. But they both got thrust into these war zones, and they both adjusted to them and did well. I mean, Robert Ford finally retired from the Foreign Service because they offered him a job in a peaceful country, and he thought that was going to be too boring.
Oh, wow. Wow. You think that's what you would hope for, you know? But, you know, let's talk about Robert Ford taken hostage. Story is something else.
Yes. I mean, the whole story is amazing. Like I said, he was a guy who, you know, thought he was going to have a career in quiet places, you know, learning all this Arabic history and becoming having better Arabic than anybody in the Foreign Service. They sent him to Iraq, or he volunteered to go to Iraq right after the U.S. invasion.
Mm.
And they sent him out to become the kind of one-man government of this province in the center of Iraq, Najaf province. And, you know, it was a totally chaotic time. There was basically nobody else there in charge. All the utilities had stopped working. There was an American Marine battalion there for a while, and then they left. And Robert had to just kind of, you know, get by as best he could and try to get things going. And so the American officials in Baghdad gave him this pile of American money and said, go out and start trying to get the government working, trying to get the local economy working. And it was just impossible, as you can imagine. One day he went out to meet with this local religious leader. And when he got there, he had a couple of cups of tea, which is what the Iraqis do customarily. And suddenly this group of militants, this militia, breaks in. They knock down the door. They grab Robert's translator, who's a young Iraqi dental student. They take him outside and start beating him up. And then they announce to Robert and the American military aide that he's with that they're holding them captive indefinitely. So, you know, Robert doesn't know what's going to go on. Are they going to be shot? Are they going to be held indefinitely like the American diplomatic hostages in Iran back in 1979? What's going to happen? They didn't have any idea, but these people were hostile. So, you know, hours went by. Their fate was uncertain, and finally they were released. But it was not, you know, it was by no means certain that they would get away.
How do they not travel with security or some sort of military? Because you go to these areas like that. How is that even possible that a scenario like that could play out?
Well, that's a good question. As time has passed, as these years since 9/11 have come and gone, and especially after Benghazi, the U.S. State Department has gotten much more careful about having bodyguards with all these people. Now they travel almost all the time in big convoys with armored Suburbans and lots of guards around. But in some of these situations, such as this place that that Robert was in, he didn't have bodyguards until almost the end of the time that he was there. And so his choices were either to stay in the place that he lived and not go out and not meet with the Iraqis, or to go out and take some risks. So that's what he did. He went out, with either, only light protection or with no protection at all. His former boss told him, Robert, you got to go out and get yourself a handgun and get some training in that, with that gun. And Robert did that. But, if he had met trouble, if he had met one of these militant groups, that wouldn't have done much to protect him, really. He just felt he needed to take the risk to get the job done.
Wow. Then you talk about the Colombian drug wars, negotiating, Ann Patterson was there. That seems to be a very dangerous setup to begin with. Even at the onset of it, seems to be very dangerous.
Yes. Ann Patterson was the ambassador in El Salvador before that all began. And El Salvador had come through its civil war and was becoming a little more peaceful. But then the U.S. got really interested in what was happening in Colombia, because it looked like this insurgency that was financed with drug money might knock over the government there. And so you probably remember that time about the year 2000, when all the attention in the U.S. was on what was happening in Colombia. And the question was, is this government going to collapse? And is there going to be just an upheaval in South America? So Washington began a huge aid program to give them military support and other things. And Ann Patterson volunteered to be the ambassador to Colombia. And this was such a scary looking job that there were only two other applicants who wanted to, put in their bid for this job. And she got it. And fortunately, it worked out pretty well. You may remember the violence began to decline. The Colombian government got stronger, and the insurgents basically retreated back into the jungle after that big American program started going.
Some pressure there. That's some pressure. A lot on your shoulders trying to work something like that out. Not the uncertainty of it all alone added probably more than most people could bear. You know, if people wanted to check out your book, The Ambassadors, they can go to Amazon. Is that the best place to go?
Well, it's available on a number of, online booksellers. Mm-hmm. You can find it in any place books are sold, basically.
Oh,
it's all over the place.
We have some great bookstores here in St. Louis, some local bookstores. And I just wanted to go, and it's funny because I hopped onto Amazon. I see number one in Pakistan history. You're beating out Gandhi on the top charts right now. So that could be a selling point alone, beating out Gandhi. Can you hold on for one more segment?
Sure.
I'd love to. Author that's joining us now, he wrote The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. He's written about foreign policy. He's traveled. He's looked in talking about the story of four ambassadors, four diplomats from the United States, and some of the things that they encountered while working. Author Paul Richter will continue with him next in Overnight America KMOX.
This is Overnight America, sponsored by Michaels Flooring, the flooring experts. MichaelsFlooringOutlet.com on KMOX.
The new book that's out called The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines, author Paul Richter. Thank you for spending time with us tonight on KMOX.
Glad to be with you.
You care about these rankings? I was looking more at Amazon. So let's see, you're number 9 in Central Asia and number 26 on Iraq history. How about that?
I'm moving up.
Ah, so do you even pay attention to things like that?
I'm not really paying attention, but my wife, who's also a journalist, is watching it feverishly every morning. She tells me how I'm doing in Kyrgyzstan.
So she really dives into the analytics side of this.
Yep.
Was it like this with any of your other work? Has she always been like that?
She really likes to get online and find out all these things. She's written a book herself about Nancy Reagan, so she's thinking about book sales.
Oh, I see. That makes sense. Yeah, that's just part of it. Some people get the Google alert set up for their name and their book title and all of that, and you know, some people, they have someone else that has a higher interest on that side. You know, let's talk about this. When you were writing this book, what were the conversations you were having with your wife about it? What were the things she was curious about as a journalist?
Well, she covers politics, and so she's interested in it. I think she was interested a lot in Ann Patterson because Ann Patterson is... was really one of the highest ranking, most experienced and well-regarded women in the State Department. And Patterson's reputation just kept rising and rising. They basically gave her every tough job possible, and she kept going back for more. So my wife was really impressed by Ann Patterson, and the two of them just met recently. It was an interesting meeting. Mm.
You know, you're looking back, and it's not too distant in the past, some of the different conditions these diplomats were working under. Has a lot changed since then in the way that the diplomats are handling their business today?
Well, as I say, there's this issue about safety and how much safety is necessary. There's also an issue about, you know, to what extent the U.S. is going to continue to be deeply involved in the Middle East. And there's a debate about that. As you know, President Trump wants to wind down all the wars. But there's a question about if we pull back and then conditions get worse and the oil supply is threatened or our allies are threatened, will we have to go back in with our military? So that's a big issue that's kind of hanging out there and that people are arguing about.
Yeah. How do you even become a diplomat? Like, is there a diplomat school out there?
Yes. I mean, these people are in the Foreign Service, which is a small group that most Americans don't know much about. But they start out, they have to take this really tough test. They say that it's like the ultimate smarty pants test. Mm-hmm. It's a test of general knowledge, and only about 3% of the people who take the test pass it. And if you pass it, then they'll invite you to join the Foreign Service, and you go in and you start training, and you know, you work your way up over a period of years, and if you're really good, you can become an ambassador.
Wow. You know, we have trivia nights here. It's very popular in St. Louis. I'm guessing it's much more difficult than that.
Yeah, it may be similar to that. It's a lot of stuff about general knowledge, but it's kind of tilted toward facts about international relations. So they might ask you, you know, where the Black Sea is, and they'll ask you about the Boer War and all these things of that sort. They'll ask you about the Constitution, a lot of questions about government and politics.
Yeah, well, that's good that you're well-versed in those type of topics, but do you have to learn the foreign language, or at least a little bit? You mentioned how them, you know, like Chris Stevens, for example, you'd learn some of it, but is that a requirement? You'd have to be not necessarily fluent, but just enough to be able to make do?
That's an interesting question. You know, a lot of people who are ambassadors don't speak the language because it takes time to learn these languages. But it really helps if you do know the language. A couple of the toughest languages are Mandarin Chinese, and Arabic. Generally, there's only about a handful of people in the State Department who are so good at Arabic that they can really negotiate at a high level, where there's, you know, where they're so competent that they could really kind of do a deal with Arab leaders. It's just so difficult for English speakers to learn. And generally, foreign service officers will go off for some time to get a basic education in Arabic, to get prepared to be able to speak basic conversational Arabic. When Ryan Crocker started getting assignments in the Middle East, he went off and spent some time with a Bedouin family, a sheep herding family in Jordan for a while, to help him learn his Arabic. Wow. And he learned that living with the Bedouins is really tough. They work a really, really long day, and then they stay up well into the night to talk about family history.
Oh, wow.
And so you stay up till, I don't know what, late at night, and then you wake up before dawn to start taking care of the animal. So
yeah, it's no vacation.
Tough life out there.
So again, if people wanted to look up The Ambassadors, what's the best place they can find your book?
Well, they can go online and find it in any, you know, in any of the places, Amazon, Target, Barnes & Noble, all these websites sell it, or they can go to the local bookstore. Any place, basically, that books are sold, it should be out there.
What a great part of preserving some American history that a lot of people don't think much about. You know, it's out of sight, out of mind. We know they're doing good work, but really to learn these stories are important to share. The book is called The Ambassadors, America's Diplomats on the Front Lines. And author Paul Richter, thank you so much for spending the time with us here tonight on Overnight America.
I enjoyed it.
Really fascinating. Don't hesitate when you go to the bookstore. Ask for it. The Ambassadors. At least touch it, feel it, take a look at it, see if it's for you. I'm sure you'll enjoy it.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.